This week, we explore concepts of Masonic leadership using three archetypes in a paper by Brother Doyle Freeman. The sharing leader, the reconciling leader, the building leader. Which do you represent? Then we open up another chapter in Alphonse Sirze's virtual book on Freemasonry when he talks about Masonry's most valuable asset. Is it philosophy? Is it a search for truth? Is it just friendship? Illustrious Brother Stephen L. Harrison stops by with another amazing installment of the Masonic Minute. Baseball legend Mordecai Brown. Did a childhood accident keep him from joining the Masons and create, possibly, the greatest pitcher baseball has ever known? Finally, we'll wrap it up with a piece on the intrinsic symbol of secrecy in Freemasonry. What makes it so valuable? Does its secret relate to the law of attraction? All this and more coming right up. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back. This is episode number 470. Right off the top, just want to go ahead again and thank our supporters. Whether you're on Patreon or on PayPal, our contributors, our fellows, our producers of the program, you guys make this happen, and I am so grateful to be able to continue to bring this show to you every single week, 50 weeks a year. If you are wanting to know how you can assist the WCY podcast, you certainly can head on over to WCYpodcast.com, click on Support the Show, and you'll see a few ways to do that. You can become a contributor, a fellow, or a producer on either Patreon or on PayPal. Whichever way fits your style, your way, the best, we have it available to you. Those are monthly contributor levels. Also, if that doesn't suit you and you just want to send a one-time gift, you can do so also just at the bottom of the page there to make a one-time gift. All money goes right back into this show and to bring you excellent Masonic content. Again, we've been doing this show since 2011, almost 10 years now, and it is a lot of work in addition to all of the other things that we do. Just like you all are super busy and you find time to do some great work, same thing here. So I appreciate anything you can do in support of the WCY podcast. If you'd like to just do some shopping and get a little bang for your buck, then you can head on over to the Limited Edition Shop where you can get the Producer's Pin. You can get the Masonicon Chicago limited gear we have available. You can get It's Business Time, Adapting a Corporate Path for Freemasonry, a book I wrote with Brother John Ruark where we took quite a bit of the best business strategies and adapted them to Freemasonry to see how they work here in our craft. Here's a little quote on the book. As someone with an MBA, I have long studied some of the best business practices and how to use these in organizations that I have been associated with. Brothers Johnson and Ruark have assembled some of the most innovative approaches used by successful companies and have illustrated how to adopt these for use in Freemasonry. This book is not about making Freemasonry a business, but rather applying these principles in building a successful lodge. I highly recommend this book to anyone looking for new and innovative ideas, end quote. And that comes from Greg Knott, past master, St. Joseph Lodge. And he's a senior contributor over at the Midnight Freemasons. And he wrote this, you know, from a business perspective. So if that interests you, check that out. That's on our website. And it's also available on Amazon.com and on Audible. If you order any of those products for $2 as an add-on, you can also get the little Hello Hiram pin that we've produced. It's just kind of a neat little bonus. My thanks to everybody who checked out the 13 Questions podcast and to anybody who is going to check out the Meet, Act, and Part podcast. I think it's going to be episode number 25. Not quite out yet, but by the time you listen to this, it might be out. So give it a listen. We'll have links back to that in the show notes as well. All right, to kick it off this week, our Masonic education, a little piece on Masonic administration. Now, I know this is not for our esoteric-minded brethren, but I think there's a common thread that's inside administration when we're talking about holistic and humanistic values in the management of a lodge. So this is called Masonic Leadership. It's by E. Doyle Freeman. Now, and this was published in an issue of the Louisiana Freemason. Introduction. The role of a leader in a volunteer organization is a special challenge. It requires thoughtful understanding of the group to be led. This is especially true in a Masonic organization because the lodge, in most instances, is composed of some members who have proven capacities for leadership and others who may have no training or experience in any type of leadership role. Your role also requires an understanding of Masonry, its tenets, its teachings, its practices, its organization, and the authority and responsibility of the Worshipful Master and other officers of the Lodge, both elected and appointed. When leadership is discussed regarding the Masonic Lodge, it is extremely important to understand the authority and responsibility of the Worshipful Master. Because of the Worshipful Master's sovereign authority and power within the Lodge proceedings, a person with little or no leadership qualities or training will be very ineffective in conducting the Lodge affairs and accomplishing the many objectives and tasks that must be done during the year. However, a Worshipful Master who can organize his plans for the year can envision the obstacles of manpower, monetary needs, time restraints, etc., and can enlist the help of other Lodge members to work in a unified force toward achieving the goals. We'll have a very successful and enjoyable year as Worshipful Master, and the Lodge will benefit. With these general precepts, you must understand the unique composition of your own Lodge. Is it a young Lodge? An older Lodge? Does it have specific areas of weakness that you should address in your year? Knowing the needs of your Lodge will help you define your role as the Lodge's chief executive. So, when do you begin to think about your year as Worshipful Master and begin to plan for it? Obviously, it should start long before you're actually installed. You should start to prepare yourself as soon as you get elected or appointed to your first station and have hopes and ambitions of serving in the various chairs and eventually becoming the Worshipful Master. The junior warden station in some lodges becomes the first real, quote-unquote, test of a person's leadership and planning abilities. For example, in the Slidell Lodge, the junior warden is responsible for all refreshments at each meeting and meals for all open meetings, working within the budget, providing the food, preparing the dining area, serving the members and guests, cleanup, etc. A lot of pre-planning, preparation, and coordination of many people are involved. After this initial test, the senior warden's position has relatively little outside responsibility because it is here the senior warden develops his plan for his year as Worshipful Master and begins to consider the most qualified, dedicated, and promising members for the appointed positions. This is perhaps the most critical year in the short career of a Worshipful Master. To be an effective leader of the Lodge, you must set realistic goals that may be implemented during the year. You must also evaluate your position relative to the other members of the Lodge. Are you involved in any clique that might make it difficult for you to lead effectively? It is essential to know where you stand with others in any administrative position, but particularly one in a volunteer organization. What kind of Worshipful Master do you want to be? The way you view your leadership role will go a long way towards shaping decisions you make as Worshipful Master. In any case, there is one quality you will need to demand of yourself as leader: flexibility, because you will be leading volunteers. You cannot overly reprimand or terminate them if they fail to perform. That is to say, you cannot be so critical and harsh in your dealings with your fellow officers and/or members that you begin to alienate them from acting as a team. Tact, consider for another's feelings, and common courtesies are always good rules to follow. What are the various styles of leadership? With flexibility as the key, we can say that there are three fundamental modes of leadership in a volunteer organization: the leader who shares responsibility for the leader who reconciles differing factions, the leader who chiefly builds on what has been done before. An unusually gifted leader may be able to use all three styles as the occasion demands, but most people will tend to favor one style over the other. 1. The sharing leader. Shares responsibility with other Lodge officers. The sharing leader may receive less public attention, but will surely achieve greater results than the Worshipful Master who has difficulty delegating authority. The role of this type of leader is that of delegator in the midst of personal interaction. Note, as a point of information, it must be noted that while authority may be delegated, you cannot delegate responsibility. You may assign responsibility to the person to whom you have delegated authority so that person may effectively accomplish the task assigned. Although you may delegate authority and assign the responsibility for performing, you, as worshipful master, are still ultimately responsible for all that happens in the lodge during your year. 2. The reconciling leader. Even within the fellowship of masonry, there are times when pressures and tensions create factions in the lodge. No greater contribution to a lodge can be made than by a worshipful master who strives to restore harmony and friendship. Reconciling leaders may not see their cherished projects realized during their year in office, but will undoubtedly pave the way for growth in many areas for the worshipful masters who follow him. During the term of such a worshipful master, a lodge can solve thorny problems. 3. The building leader. A worshipful master should know what to change and what to build on. Much energy is lost when a project is launched one year and dropped the next, before it is completed and another is started in its place. However, it is not an example of good leadership to allow something to continue just because it's always been done that way. Summing up, outstanding leaders of volunteers are realistic people who can measure themselves and their goals for the lodge in relation to the facts around them. Examples being the resources and manpower they have to work with, chiefly their committee chairman. Such leaders are able to keep their forces in balance and to work to increase their assets and diminish their liabilities. Brief leadership tips. Old-fashioned leaders have a heroic concept of their role. They must be everywhere at once and do everything themselves. This is unfortunate because it stifles their committee members' initiative. On the other hand, successful leaders in a volunteer organization are friendly and understanding, communicate frequently and open with their committee members, provide frequent encouragement and motivation, praise lodge members for a job well done, harmonize differences, attempt to enable team members to work to their full potential, take pleasure in developing the leadership talents of younger members in the lodge. Time management, an irrefutable rule. Any number of books have been written on how an executive should manage time, but there is one sure pathway to more efficient use of time, and it can be simply stated. Because of your unique position and complete authority as worshipful master of your lodge, you are the only one who has all the relevant information and resources to know the difference between which matters are truly important for your lodge and which matters are merely urgent to the person who brings them to your attention. Your phone rings constantly or will immediately upon your installation in the East, and you know that certain matters are critical for you to accomplish in a given time period, and you know what should be deferred no matter how urgent it seems to the person who brings it to your attention. The rule: unless emergency interferes, keep your eye on the larger goals and let the merely urgent wait. Not too long, but let it wait while you get the truly important things done. Lastly, as you continue your year in your present position, and especially to those who will assume positions of responsibility in their lodge next year, please remember this little phrase and perhaps pass it along to your new officers. Realize that you, in essence, have volunteered to serve the lodge in either an elected or appointed capacity. Remember, you are a volunteer until you volunteer. Once you volunteer, you then are a mason with a job to do! ! Well, there you have this piece by Brother E. Doyle Freeman from the Louisiana Freemason. I found some things within this paper really interesting to point out. So, in the paper, right off the top, it talks about starting to plan for your year in the East the second you kind of know that you're going to go down that road. I think that's really important, and I know that people say, well, it's wrong to start planning and to start putting things into action because you don't know that you're ever going to be in that position. Will you get elected to the East? And we all know the answer. This is just almost a platitude of being polite. Unless there's some crazy contention in your lodge, you're going to be elected. So people should be okay with you doing things and planning them. It's no hit to you that you're starting to do these things. And if somebody comes up to you and has a real problem with you starting to make plans, this may be because they know you and they know that what you're thinking about doing might not align to what they want. And so there may be a conflict there. So it's something to address. And that might be why they're telling you, hey, you shouldn't be planning this stuff yet because you're not elected or whatever the case is. So just keep those things in mind. The author of the piece sums up this bit about being a volunteer, and this is really important. Freemasonry is volunteer when you're a member of the lodge. However, once you do volunteer, it's a job, and you should faithfully do that job to the best of your ability. And I don't mean, oh, it's okay if you fail here and there. No, 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 no. This is your job until you're replaced. And leading up to that, when he says in this paper early on that you should be able to, that you can't fire people, etc., that is not true. You can fire somebody from their lodge. You can ask them to step down and replace them. But it's also very important to understand that you do this in a way that is mindful of people's feelings. Hey, Bob, listen, I've noticed that, you know, this, and this has happened, and we kind of need to make sure that this does happen for our lodge. I'm wondering if you'd like to share that job with Brother Joe, because he's here to step in a little bit to kind of help pick up so that we can meet our goals here. And at that point, if he says, you know, I'm out of here, fine, whatever, well, that's just the way it is, okay? But we have lodges to manage. We have lodges to bring to a level of excellence. And it's okay to have expectations. If you take anything away from my commentary on the piece, just know that my main bullet is that you can have expectations. And that's really important. All right, now this next one, I believe, was originally published at the Illinois Lodge of Research by Alphonse Cerza. Some of you recognize that name from a few episodes ago that we kind of dedicated an episode to one of his papers. Now, Alphonse Cerza was the Grand Historian of the Grand Lodge, or AFNAM, of Illinois, and he is pretty prolific here in the state of Illinois. His writing desk and a couple other implements are actually preserved in a Masonic library and museum outside of Illinois, actually, if you can believe that. But let's get into this cool piece that he did, and it's called Our Most Valuable Asset. Now, what do you think that is? Is it the working tools, the philosophy, the degrees, the ritual? Well, Alphonse Cerza says our most valuable asset is friendship. Let's check it out. Freemasonry has many facets which have attracted men of goodwill of every race, religion, political view, and social position into its ranks throughout the world for many years. Every member has his own individual reason for joining the craft, but generally, its chief appeal is that charitable work that it does. The philosophy of life taught by the craft, with its visible exhibition by Freemasons in their exemplary conduct in the everyday world. All these items are important, but to the non-member who has given this matter any thought whatsoever, it soon becomes apparent that the greatest asset in Freemasonry is the spirit of friendship that exists between Freemasons in their relationship with one another and their attitude of thoughtfulness for the welfare of others. For example, many years ago, the words Mason and friendship were often used synonymously. Our historical background supports this view. Dr. James Anderson, in his Constitutions of Freemasons, published in 1723, reflected the traditional fundamental principles of the craft when he stated the first charge that, quote, Masonry becomes the center of union and the means of conciliating true friendship among persons that must have remained at a perpetual distance, end quote. And in 1738 edition of the same book, the wording was changed slightly, but the meaning was the same when he stated, quote, Thus Masonry is the center of their union and the happy means of conciliating persons that otherwise must have remained at a perpetual distance, end quote. This idea was not new with Anderson, since the idea of friendship prevailed in the ancient manuscripts, which required the members to address themselves as quote-unquote brothers, attend to their religious duties, respect other members of the craft, and that all lodge members be considerate of each other, both inside and outside the craft. There were also provisions that members help each other in finding employment or giving work to members seeking employment, or to give them money to enable them to travel to the next place where employment might be available. Furthermore, when the Grand Lodge was formed in 1717 in London, the leaders adopted a non-sectarian rule and also prohibited the discussion of political matters in the lodge. These new rules were intended to eliminate friction and disharmony among the members and further promoted the idea of friendship. requiring a belief in God, teaching that all men are brothers and that we should always be kind and charitable toward others, has created an atmosphere of harmony among the members and has promoted the development of warm and enduring friendships between the members of the craft. It has also encouraged our members to be good neighbors, good citizens, and to be loyal to the established government. There are many definitions of the word friend. It means one who is in a warm personal relationship with another person. It means a person who is ready to assist you in your plans. Many years ago, an English periodical had a contest and offered a prize to the person submitting the best definition of the word friend. Here are a few of the definitions which were sent to the publication. One who multiplies joys, divides grief, and whose honesty is inviolable. One who understands our silence. A watch which beats true, and for all time and never runs down. And here is the definition that won first prize. A friend is the one who comes in when the whole world has gone out. Many years ago, my father stated to me that the most valuable thing that anyone can have is a friend. But then he added that in order to have a friend, you must be a friend. On other occasions, he would say that a friend is worth more than 1,000 ducats. You will note that the idea is in the nature of a two-way street. Freemasonry, with its emphasis on the obligations that we owe to others, exemplifies this idea of the value of friendship in the strongest way possible. What great persons have said about the subject of friends is of interest because the statements reveal a deep need for friends and their importance in the lives of persons to make them happy. Aristotle, in his Nicomachean Ethics, said, quote, "The perfect friendship is that between good men, alike in their virtues." Keats, the great English poet, compared friends to a, quote-unquote, "a beacon light guiding a ship into a port on a dark and misty night." Brother George Washington, in one of his letters, said, quote, "Actions, not words, are the true criterion of attachments of friends." Thomas Jefferson, "One gives meaningful expression to friendship only when he does something thoughtful, unselfish, or pleasantly surprising for the person he esteems." In a poetic mood, Oliver Wendell Holmes described friendship as, quote, "the breathing rose with sweets in every fold." Seneca, the Roman savant, said, "Friendship sweetens all our cares and dispels our sorrows." Coleridge, the English poet, "Friendship is a sheltering tree." Sir Francis Bacon wrote that friendship redoubleth joys and cutteth griefs in half. And let us not forget the lesson exemplified in the 15th Scottish Rite degree of the Northern Masonic Jurisdiction. Life without friends is worthless. The true value of friends cannot be underestimated. There is nothing worse than being alone or having the feeling that there is no one around you that you can rely on for help and companionship. Nothing can be more depressing than the feeling that there is no one that cares about your welfare. On the positive side, the mere fact that one knows that he has friends is a comforting feeling, so that the possession of friends is an absolute necessity in life in order to be happy. I remember an old friend who was a bachelor and had no close relatives. He lived in a rooming house where most of his fellow roomers were transients. Being a member of the craft opened up many opportunities for him to spend his time profitably. Rather than going to his room each evening after work, he managed to go to his lodge on each meeting night. He also, quote-unquote, adopted a number of other lodges within a reasonable distance and visited them regularly. Many of the members of those lodges saw him so regularly that they never realized that he was only a visitor and not a regular member of that lodge. He always pitched in when there was a need for workers, and he made himself useful. At these lodge meetings, he paid special attention to the reports about members, and he took notes. On nights that he was not attending lodge meetings, he visited sick members, offered to do things for them, and cheered them up with his presence. Thus he was being a real friend toward his fellow members, and it gave him a genuine lift to feel that he was utilizing his time doing something worthwhile. This illustrates how Masonic friendship is a two-way street, and that benefits result to everyone with these many contacts at meetings and with other relationships. I am also reminded of the member who came from a family in which he was an only child. He missed the usual activity within a family unit where there are a number of brothers and sisters. When he joined the craft, he acquired a large number of brothers, and he acquired the feeling that he was no longer alone. To him, the word brother meant a great deal more than it did to the average member. Joining the craft was a deeply moving experience for him, for he realized that he had acquired an unspecified number of friends to whom he was bound by an obligation stronger than any physical binding could be. The members who become active in his Masonic Lodge and engages in its work by necessity will be in contact constantly with other members who are also similarly engaged. Taking part in a meaningful and worthwhile projects with other good men creates a camaraderie between them which blossoms forth into intangible and unexpressed respect by one person for another. Because of these projects, Freemasonry offers unlimited opportunity with the creation of warm and close friendships among its members. The Mason who does not regularly attend Lodge meetings and also engages in some work for the Lodge and its members misses one of the valuable assets which the Lodge has to offer its members, the opportunity to make friends. Another element which contributes to this development of close friendships within the craft is the philosophy that Masons are taught to be charitable, and that this word is to be construed in its broadest sense. To the Mason, it means more than just giving alms. It means more than writing a check for worthy cause. It means that you will go that extra mile to help another person in need of help beyond any call of duty. It means that you will listen to a brother's troubles as he seeks to unburden himself of his feelings or desires to talk things over with someone. It means to sympathize with a person who is in pain or in trouble and thereby help them to lighten the burden. The lesson of the faithful breast and the listening ear are always before us. Masons who join appendant bodies of the craft often do so in order to expand their Masonic contact and to extend their charitable work because these bodies always have such projects. When good men gather to accomplish something that will benefit the craft, its members, and the community, these types of associations are by necessity ones that cover long periods of time and require many hours of working together with good men to accomplish worthy goals. Such increased associations is bound to develop mutual respect among members working together, which will develop into warm friendship. When a Mason meets another Mason for the first time, he knows that the other person believes in God and that he therefore believes that all men are brothers, and that as a result he must be kind to other persons and help them in every possible way. Such knowledge is bound to bring the two persons closer together, for they instinctively realize that they have many beliefs in common. You know, without any express statement, that a spiritual tie exists between Masons because you can expect honorable conduct from the new contact. For one who travels extensively, Masonic friendship manifests itself time and time again. Whether it is visiting a Masonic lodge or attending a meeting of an appendant body, or in the marketplace, when you meet another Mason, you always feel a kinship with him. You always find the door open with a welcome sign. This can be valuable if you are in a strange place. It becomes doubly valuable if you are in need of suggestions, advice, or help of some kind. You not only have a comfortable feeling because you know help is near, but there is also a feeling of trust and faith that is so valuable in all human relationships. Non-Masons often have observed that there exists between Masons an elusive something that creates a spirit of friendly relations between Masons. It is to be noted that strangers who meet and discover that both are members of the craft immediately feel a kinship with each other. Masons recognize this mutual feeling and describe it as the tie that binds. But this general description mystifies and intrigues non-members. He notes the friendly feeling that exists between the members, though they may have just met. But he does not realize that, when Masons meet for the first time, they instinctively feel a close relationship because of the unique teaching methods used in the conferring of the three degrees, whereby certain obligations are assumed, which bind Masons to a high moral code, which makes them better men on the spiritual and moral level. This valuable asset of Freemasonry too often is so obscured that few of our members are aware of it. We should call this to their attention. Having a large number of friends will make a person happier, a better person, help make this a better place in which to live. This elusive element of Freemasonry is the most valuable asset that each of us has as a member of the craft, and it is also one of the most valuable assets of Freemasonry as an organization. Well, I don't have much to add to that. I think Alphonse Sirza certainly defined what friendship is, the holistic and intrinsic elements that we all kind of feel internally about our closest friends. I'm sure many of you might have been listening to this and thought, yeah, that's the way I do feel. I feel that way about my close friends. Oh yes, I do that because it makes me feel better when I know they're feeling better. For sure, I have experienced that, meeting a brother on the street for the first time and feeling that we are instantly best friends. Another great piece by Alphonse Sirza. Now, let's get into this week's Masonic Minute with illustrious brother, Stephen L. Harrison.
You may never have heard of this brother, but he is ranked among the greats. He stands beside the likes of Sandy Koufax, Cy Young, Christy Mathewson, Lefty Grove, Roger Clemens, and a handful of others whose skill at throwing a baseball seemed to be supernatural. He was so good, the annual Cy Young Award for the best pitcher in baseball might well have been named the Mordecai Brown Award. Born in 1876 in Niceville, Indiana, a small town about 45 miles west of Indianapolis, Brown was a member of Edward Dobbin's Lodge No. 164 in Lawrenceville, Illinois. He was a standout Chicago Cubs pitcher who won 20 or more games for six straight seasons. In 1908, as a fielding pitcher, he did not commit a single error and pitched a record four shutout games in a row. Against the great Christy Mathewson, considered by some to be the best pitcher in baseball, he won 13 games out of 24 times they met. Overall, he won 239 games against 130 losses and struck out 1,375 batters. His spectacular 2.06 earned run average today remains the best of any pitcher who won over 200 games. There is more to his story as a Freemason. There was a time in the craft, in some jurisdictions, when a physical deformity disqualified a man from becoming a member. As a young man, Brown lost the index finger on his right hand in a farming accident. While still healing from that injury, he fell and broke several bones in his remaining fingers. Doctors reset the middle finger improperly, further mangling his hand. When he petitioned to become a Freemason, he was rejected due to his mutilated hand. Only the intervention of a district deputy grand master won him dispensation and allowed him to join. Brown's disfigured pitching hand forced him to grip a baseball in an unorthodox way. There has never been any doubt that his grip made the ball travel in a way that made his pitches extremely difficult to hit and contributed to his success as a pitcher, earning him the name by which he became famous, Mordecai Three Finger Brown. He won games on two World Series winning teams in 1907 and 1908, the last time the Cubs won the series for over a century. He retired from the majors in 1916 and moved to Terre Haute, Indiana, where he continued to play and coach in minor league games. In 1928, a friend asked him to play in an exhibition game as a favor. It was the last time he played, and in that game, the 51-year-old Brown pitched three innings, striking out all nine batters he faced. I personally share something in common with Brother Mordecai. Just before becoming a Freemason, I suffered a similar injury. I didn't lose any fingers, but the little finger on my right hand was permanently disfigured. Most people don't notice, but let's put it this way. I'll never be a hand model. Brown passed away in 1948 at the age of 71. A year later, he was posthumously elected to the Major League Baseball Hall of Fame. If it were not for the fact that Freemasonry gave up on its barbaric, backward, Neanderthal practice of rejecting men with deformities as members, the great Mordecai Three Finger Brown would never have become a Freemason, along with others like him, including myself. For the Whence Came You podcast, this is Steve, 3½ Finger Harrison, with the Masonic Minute.
All right, what a great Masonic Minute with Steve, 3½ Finger Harrison. This was a great and really insightful piece. I love baseball. I don't follow it as much as I used to when I was a kid living in California. You know, we had the California Angels and I would go to the games all the time with my grandparents. It was a big to-do. And I love baseball and I love the legends about baseball. I know I share that fascination with probably a brother that has more baseball knowledge than anybody I know, and that's Brother Nathan Tweedy. So, Brother Nathan, if you're out there listening, I hope you enjoyed this segment, and I want to thank illustrious Brother Harrison for putting this one together. What a great story. I had first learned of the prohibition against anybody with a deformity from Brother Michael Shirley, Dr. Michael Shirley. He posted a piece about a Grandmaster's decision to repeal such prohibition in Freemasonry in the Grand Lodge of Illinois. If you're interested in that, I'll dig it up and I'll put a link to it in the show notes for you all. All right, our last piece for this week comes from Connecticut Philosophic Lodge of Research, which was published in 1972, written by Brother James M. Desmond, who was actually the Grand Master of Masons in Connecticut in 1978. So a few years after writing this paper, he served as the Grand Master. This paper begins. The ideas presented in this paper are in response to a question that arises in the mind of nearly every newly made Mason. Perhaps a month or two from the time he is raised, a helpful brother presents the surprising news that all our secrets have been exposed. It may come up during an instruction session, or the new brother may be already trying to find out how much of the work is secret, and how much he can tell to his wife. Or it may be in the talk over coffee after the lodge is closed. In any event, the brother learns that the ritual work, the signs and words, and everything else can be found written down in a book, an exposé. And he probably learns who has such a book. However it comes about, the new brother begins to wonder why he was made to understand that Masons took secrecy so seriously, and if he has been somewhat gullible for adopting a similar attitude. He wonders about it. He remembers the penalties. How is he to resolve this inconsistent situation? On the other hand, he is sworn to secrecy. The lodge is tiled to prevent unauthorized intrusion, and visitors are examined to see if they are Masons and deserving to be admitted. On the other hand, he finds that there remains no real secrecy, yet no one seems greatly concerned. If he asks, they kind of shrug and change the subject. If a Mason feels this way about secrecy, do they likewise take the other teachings lightly and of no great importance? Do Masons go through elaborate ritualistic means to present great ideas of morality and brotherly love and then have no more concern for these principles than they apparently have for the practice of secrecy? Of course, there is no doubt that Masons take their teachings and secrecy seriously. It is not the purpose of this discussion to consider such questions. Neither will we discuss the usual traditional basis for secrecy. They do not provide a satisfactory answer in the sense sought here. The approach taken here will be much narrower in scope, perhaps even a technical approach. We will try to understand how the continued practice of secrecy can be necessary, not only because of its inherent position among the landmarks as an essential ingredient of our philosophy, but because it has a practical purpose, that of ensuring the success of our methods of teaching. To see how the method used by Masonry for so long depends on secrecy for effectiveness. To show that secrecy is valuable, not because it keeps those outside of the temple from finding what goes on within, but because it makes the lessons within more effective for those being taught. We can even go so far as to say that the enduring success of the order for generations depends as much on this effective method of presenting the teachings as it does on their content. We will show that Masonic method is consistent with rules for learning, rules which require active involvement on the part of the one being instructed. Furthermore, the practice of secrecy enforces teaching according to this principle of active involvement. Let us examine in turn then the traditional practices used in Masonry, the role of secrecy, and possibility of further improvement in approaches to our goals which make use of findings from the science of learning. 1. Learning principles. One principle of learning is that an idea is learned better when we become more deeply involved with it. If there is a skill to be learned, such as riding a bike or driving a car, then muscular activity plays a part and calls into the use additional avenues of perception. Such muscular skills are extremely well learned and retained for a long time, even after long periods of disuse. If the thing to be learned is an idea or a thought, we learn and remember it better by going over it in our minds, examining it, trying it out in different situations. We get deeply involved, and the learning takes place at a deep level in our minds. On the other hand, ideas that we receive only passively in the conscious thinking levels of our minds make little lasting impression. Concepts thus deeply learned are embedded in our minds and become a part of ourself. They play a most important part in controlling our future thoughts, actions, and responses to various situations. This process of deep learning has been going on in each of us since infancy, consciously or unconsciously. It can be a powerful force shaping the characters of men according to the highest standards, inculcating the virtues of brotherly love, relief, and truth. It continues throughout our lifetime, forming our personality, shaping our character. Masonry, to reach its goal of character development, tries to impress in our minds tremendous lessons. In its methods, Masonry takes its candidates by the hand and literally leads them in involved participation into the beautiful ceremonies and lectures. Masonic instruction in this manner clearly impresses the lessons on its candidates, not by passive exposure, but by active experience. Masonry has known and used this simple principle for hundreds of years. Our instruction is imparted by the ritual only. Candidates have to participate, get involved in the experience that they undergo. Merely reading matter that we want to learn is not as effective. The information is held in the conscious training levels of the mind. It may not reach the deeper levels where it becomes part of ourself. If the lessons could be so easily learned, the ritual would not be necessary, but they cannot. Masonic teaching requires the active participation of the candidate. With this understanding of the method of learning, which has long been used in Masonry, it will be easy to see its relation to secrecy, or rather, the role played by secrecy in the Masonic method. 2. Secrecy. Besides being essential to the form of Masonry we know, and in spite of the fact that these secrets can be obtained in a clandestine manner outside the lodge, the importance of secrecy lies in the part it plays in protecting the prospective candidate from learning or being exposed to the teachings without actively entering into them through the degree work. He must experience them. As far as the candidate is concerned, this simple idea provides a satisfactory answer to the question raised at the opening of this discussion. While our first thought might be that secrecy prevents the outsider from learning secrets that give us some supposed advantage, we can now see that its most important effect is to ensure that the teachings are learned by real experience under control of the ritual. We have no secrets. We would proclaim our teachings from the rooftops as loudly as we can for all to hear, if they could be learned in that manner. They are neither secret nor unique to Masonry. The Masonic method uses secrecy to ensure that the initiate receives the message with all the advantages of active experiences. This is a very important idea. It is of certain importance in the persistence of Masonry throughout the ages. Masonry continues to exist, not because it has esoteric power, but because it uses secrecy to strengthen the sound teaching principles which it uses. Secrecy is used to keep the candidates from learning the lessons in any other than the most effective manner. Masonry takes the eternal truths and, through its method of instruction by active participation, deeply embeds them in the minds and hearts of men. We are led to a concept of symbolic secrecy to the act or practice of secrecy as itself a symbol. It symbolizes the Masonic method of instruction that requires active experiencing by the candidate of the lessons in the work. This concept of secrecy as a symbol can have a dynamic effect in the lives of those who choose to become Masons and strive to perfect their skills in our art. It gives rise to a power that molds character and inculcates the higher principles of moral conduct. This is what Masonry is all about, and it can only be achieved in this manner of teaching, that is, of acquiring a deep inner level, the knowledge and beliefs which control and shape our lives in the most desirable way. The profane are excluded not by becoming unable to obtain secret knowledge about Masonry, but by being unable to profit by the unique effective means of instruction employed in the ritual. The great truths of our art are learned not by reading them or passively hearing them, but by deep active experience which puts the ideas into the innermost parts of our minds and bodies, where they become active, powerful forces controlling our behavior and shaping our lives in accord with the highest principles of moral character and personal development. 3. New approaches in old coals. Some psychologists have come to believe, as a result of controlled experiments, that improvement can be gained not only by real practice, but also by practice in the imagination. That is, once we have experienced a new idea or skill, practice in the imagination is as effective as actual practice. Thus, basketball players or golfers can improve their scores by regular practice, not on the court or fairway, but in their minds, by imagining that they are actually playing. In a controlled experiment, psychologist R.A. Vandal proved that mental practice in throwing darts at a target, wherein the person sits for a period each day in front of a target and imagines throwing darts at it, improves aim as much as actually throwing darts. Another report concerns an experiment on the effects of mental practice on improving skill in sinking basketball free throws. One group, which practiced every day in their imagination, improved in scoring as much as another group, which actually practiced. The deep inner mind, which we call the subconscious, receives its impressions of the outer world from the conscious thinking part of our brains. Since accurately imagined experiences produce the same sort of impressions as real ones, and since they follow the same channels to the subconscious mind, real experiences and imagined experiences cannot be easily distinguished by the inner mind. In this manner, the imagined practice produced the same beneficial results as the actual practice. You may wonder what all this has to do with secrecy or with Masonry. Well, if we find that secrecy supports Masonry's use of a well-known principle of learning, why can't we take advantage of a newer idea from the science of learning? Why cannot a Mason who has been properly inducted into our order gain more whenever he is present in the exemplification of one of the degrees by taking an active part by way of the imagination more than he could by sitting passively on the sidelines? Why can't we, while the officers are enlightening and instructing the candidate, accompany him in our imagination? We can imagine in great detail that we are going through the steps with the candidate. We can thus strengthen the association between the ritual and ideas it expresses so that the symbolic acts become deeply embedded in our minds. This provides a better foundation on which to build an improved concept of what our life can and should be. In these procedures, it is important to have clearly defined goals to guide the formation of impressions transmitted into our subconscious minds. The goals are found in Masonry: the development of moral character, inculcation of the Masonic virtues, charity, relief, brotherhood. Summary. First, the method of instruction used in Masonry is based on the principle, which is now well known, that active experience and deep involvement improves the process of education. Second, in addition to its traditional basis, Masonic secrecy is essential to the Masonic method of instruction, the means of ensuring that our candidates receive their instruction in the prescribed active manner. It matters not that the work is exposed, since the profane lack the quote-unquote secret of active involvement. We started out looking for a symbolic meaning in the continued practice of secrecy in Masonry. Instead, we have come to realize that secrecy is not for the purpose of excluding the profane, but for the benefit of our initiates, since it is, in effect, employed to ensure the success of our method. If we want to consider secrecy to be a symbol, it is a symbol of a method of learning by active participation. Third, in a recent extension of the principles of learning by experience, it appears that practice or rehearsal carried out in the imagination is nearly as effective as actual practice. That we can apply this extension by not sitting passively on the sidelines, but by taking part in our imagination while we are witnessing the work. Finally, and most important, those methods of learning are more effective when they are directed toward a goal. Masonry provides the clearly defined goal. It is the improvement of moral character and the inculcation of brotherly love and Masonic virtues, that all men may be brothers united in their labors, to the eternal honor of the name of the great architect of the universe. And that concludes Secrecy in Symbolism by James M. Desmond. Again, the Connecticut Philosophic Lodge of Research, 1972. I really like this piece because it is part science. It's kind of talking about the idea of the New Age watchword. What is the New Age watchword? Well, if you want to know what the New Age watchword is, head on over to WCYpodcast.com, click on About, click on Robert H. Johnson, and you can see just a little bit about me, and scroll down to the bottom of the page, and you'll see the New Age watchword. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed the show this week. Coming up on the 16th of November, I'll be presenting for Triangle Lodge. I'll be doing Esoterics 101. If you go to WCYpodcast.com, while you're there checking out that New Age watchword, you can click on the presentation schedule, and you'll see 11-16-2020 Triangle Lodge presents Esoterics 101. I'll be doing that at 7 p.m., and this will be Eastern time. So 7 p.m. Eastern is 6 p.m. Central, 4 p.m. over on the Pacific Coast. The Zoom information is there. You'll need to register. I think it auto-registers, so you can click that and register to come to the meeting. And I don't really wait very long, so maybe 5 minutes. So if it starts at 7, you know, maybe 7:05 I start. But we'll record it, and I will get it to Triangle Lodge so that they can do what they would like with it. In addition, I want to thank everybody for your support one more time to the producers, fellows, and contributors of the WCY podcast. Thank you so very much. You guys are amazing. How can you help if you don't want to donate monthly or weekly or one time or whatever the case is? It would be awesome if you would share the episode links in your Facebook groups for your lodge with your grandmaster if you have a particularly amazing episode that you love. Send it up the line. See if they like it. I'm all about trying to get this podcast in the hands of more brothers, more profane who are interested in Freemasonry. You know, this show has over 2 million listeners. That's more people listening to the show than are Masons in the U.S. Now, that's not a bragging point for what you all have created with WCY Podcast. What this is a testament to is that the world over, people are interested in the Masonic philosophy, and you've helped bring it to them, and so many people have joined Freemasonry since listening to TMR, since listening to WCY, or the Winding Stairs, TWS. You name the Masonic podcast, you name the Masonic blog. We're trying to connect, we're trying to make the world better, and we're trying to implement continued growth of the fraternity through a means that allow modern people to get connected to the fraternity. So again, this wouldn't be possible without all of the contributors, the fellows, and the producers. You guys make it happen. Lastly, before I leave you all, the Masonic Legacy Society. You know, we've been holding monthly workshops through Zoom with the Masonic Legacy Society. They are two-day workshops, and we've had so much success. So many great guys have come to do these workshops and learned and taken this back to their home lodges, their home districts, and all of this. If you want to know what I'm talking about, go to MasonicLegacySociety.com. You can read a little about us there. You can also read the document and guide. But in order to get those things, I need you to go ahead and put in your information, and then they will be automatically sent to you. If you use a Google Mail, a Gmail, it will go into your promotions folder. So make sure you're checking promotions and junk folders, because we are using Constant Contact, which gets flagged all the time for being, you know, just an advert. Of course, we are not advertising anything. We are giving away something totally for free, and all of the information you put in only comes to me, you guys. So don't worry. If you trust me, then please go here and check this out. It is available in English, French, Russian, and Spanish, and more languages are coming soon. We'll be holding our next workshops probably in December, early part of December. If you're interested, please shoot me a message through the Masonic Legacy Society's message board. Let me know who you are, what your affiliations are, and what you do in your district or in your Grand Lodge. That way we can make sure that we are aligning on focus. Again, MasonicLegacySociety.com. If you're curious about who came up with this, at the bottom of the page you can click authors, and you'll see names of people that I'm sure you know. That's it, guys. I hope you find some peace and quiet and relaxation as we move through this wild week that we've just had with elections. And at the time of recording this right now, things have not been called by the AP yet. So on we go. Please have peace of mind, be courteous, and as James Cole has reminded us, let's respond like Freemasons. Until next week, stay on the level for Whence Came You. I'm Robert Johnson. Take care, everybody.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.
WCY Media.